Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from Jupiter, Florida, and the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM. My guest is author Richard Moe. Our subject is Roosevelt and his later work with Vice President Mondale and President Carter and the National Trust for Historic Preservations. We'll be discussing Richard Moe's great book on FDR's third-term presidential run in 1940 and his experience as Chief of Staff to Vice President Mondale and his work in the Carter administration. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public different views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow, and other subjects that are of current interest. Welcome, Richard Moe, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you. You know, Richard Moe has had a distinguished career in government, law, historic preservation as a writer. He's a native of Minnesota. He was educated at Williams College and the University of Minnesota Law School. At an early age, he served in administrative positions in state and local government before being elected chairman of the Minnesota Democratic Farm Labor Party. In 1972, he was asked to serve as chief of staff to Senator Walter Mondale, and then in the same capacity when Walter Mondale became vice president. In the course of helping to shape what has become known as the modern vice presidency, President Jimmy Carter named Richard Moe is the member of his own senior staff, his first vice presidential aide to be so designated. After 12 years as a partner of the law firm of Davis, Polk & Wardwell, Moe wrote an acclaimed Civil War history, The Last Full Measure, The Life and Death of the First Minnesota Volunteers. From 1993 to 2010, he served as president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which I must add I am a member. In 2007, he received the Vince Scully. Is that the broadcaster, Vince Scully, Richard?
No, the art historian.
That's interesting. Historian. Same name, prize from the National Building right. Museum. I wondered about that. And the same year, he received the Theodore Roosevelt Woodrow Wilson Award for the American Historical Association. He served on the boards of many nonprofit organizations, including the Ford Foundation, his book Roosevelt's Second Act, which we're going to talk about, the election of 1940, and the Politics of War was published in September 2013. It was selected by the Oxford University Press to be included in its Pivotal Moments in American History series. He lives in with his wife in Washington, D.C. and Santa Fe, New Mexico. That's one place I want to go. I know they have great pottery, so I'm looking forward to Santa Fe. You know, Richard, 3 years ago, you wrote a remarkable book about FDR's second act, which chronicles how he was nominated for an, let's face it, a precedent-seeking third term. And to set the scene, the 1940 presidential election, which pitted two-term incumbent Franklin Delano Roosevelt against Wendell Willkie, was probably the most important election since 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was handed the keys to the White House. Richard, before all this came about, can you tell our audience the background of the last few years of FDR's second term?
Well, yes. He had obviously been elected in 1932, and he had a very busy and successful first term, which is usually known as the time in which the New Deal became a reality to deal with the nation's severe economic crisis stemming from the Great Depression. He was reelected by a landslide in 1936, carried all but two states. But at this time, the New Deal was starting to run its course, and FDR was shifting his focus to foreign affairs because war was threatening to break out in Europe. And he was very concerned about this and very concerned that eventually the United States would be involved. And he struggled with how to deal with that.
Now, as you stated in your book, FDR was caught between two ugly and depressing realities. If he chose to declare that he's not a candidate for office, his power and influence would quickly wane and his ability to be a world player would almost diminish to nothing, especially with a recalcitrant Congress, dominated by Dixiecrats, conservative Democrats, and newly empowered Republicans off their large gains in 1938. Richard, tell us a bit about the short but I would say virulent recession of 1937, the court packing, and the failed purge in the 38 midterm elections.
Well, those are three things that he undertook shortly after his election in 1936. which I said was a huge landslide. And he thought that he had a mandate to do these things, particularly the court packing. And the court packing plan had never been discussed during the campaign. The American people didn't know anything about it. And he hadn't consulted anybody in the Congress or elsewhere about it. So people were very much taken by surprise, and he was defeated in the U.S. Senate. And it was the most humiliating defeat legislatively that he ever suffered. At the same time, he took his foot off the economic accelerator and cut federal spending. Well, federal spending was one of the factors that was stimulating economic growth and recovery, and he did that prematurely. And the country fell into what became known as the Roosevelt Recession. 2 million more people were out of work. And then in the 1938 midterm elections, he tried to purge recalcitrant Democrats who would not support his programs, including the court packing plan. So basically, he overread his mandate of 1936. His mandate did not include doing any of these things, and he badly misjudged that, as other presidents seeking a second term have misjudged that mandate. So he was really at the nadir of his popularity, both with Congress and with the public, leading up to the second half of his second term.
You know, it's interesting, and a bit of a digression. His great friend, if you could say that FDR had any friends, and that's a question mark, and certainly an intimate consultant, Louis Howe had died right before in the 1936 election, and there seemed to be a vacuum of consultation for FDR in those 2 years. Do you think that had something to do with his possible misstep on the court? Do you think that?
Yes, I do, Richard, and I think that's very insightful of you to mention that, because Louis Howe is one of the few people in FDR's political experience, career, who could speak up to him. And who could tell him no? As a matter of fact, when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Louis Howe would hear him telling some labor leader something on the telephone, and Howe would turn to him and say, "You can't tell him that, you fool!" You know, and nobody else ever spoke to FDR like that.
Right.
But Howe had the credibility, and he was a decade older than FDR, so that helped.
Hmm.
And he didn't want anything except to serve FDR. It's very hard to find people like that that are in a position. To tell truth to power.
That's right.
And Howe could do it. And after that, it was very, very few people could do it.
And even Harry Hopkins later never had the intimate relationship that Howe had had with Roosevelt. I always have
That's
felt
true.
As a student of FDR that was a period where he almost wandered in judgment, that he looked and almost believed his own press clippings. And I think we see that with Donald Trump today. We don't.
Well, that's true, and a lot of people get caught up in that. And what happened with FDR? I might be getting a little ahead of the story here, but basically he was a loner politically.
Oh, no question.
He was, and I think you have to keep in mind he was an only child, brought up as an only child on a remote estate in upstate New York. Had few childhood friends. Very much charted his own course. And that was reinforced when he went to prep school and when he went to Harvard and throughout his career. And during this part of his presidency, he really went inward after Louis Howe died. And there was nobody on whom he could rely in any significant way for judgment.
And
that was particularly true when he came to face this decision of whether he should run for a third term.
No question. You know, I've done a lot of lectures on FDR over the years, and one of the things I've always stressed is that he had no friends, especially after his young days and polio, when people drifted away from him. And I think that happens today when people get sick, the pack leaves. And Roosevelt, innately, as you had just articulated, was an individual, was a lonely person, grown up with a very tight circle, basically his older stepbrother,
right,
to a degree, some advice who helped him, and his mother. Father died
right
when he was in Harvard. So that is a problem, and I think that Howe really became his alter ego. You know, In 1938, FDR was in relatively good health for a man who'd been enduring the effects of polio for 17 years. One could speculate easily that he did not want to leave the office until he was ready. I think most people would agree with that. And a couple of great lines about that I could tell later. He was also diverting attention by seemingly supporting others for the nomination. Who were these others in that period leading up to 1940's convention, and what were their liabilities?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Richard. And first of all, he was genuinely undecided and uncertain as to whether or not he should run for a third term. And what it really turned on in the end for him was whether or not he could help the country avoid war, or whether or not he could find somebody to replace him who would agree with his foreign and domestic policies and who could be elected in 1940. That was always the test of whether or not somebody else is available. And the only two people that were visible at that time were James Farley, who was the Vice President of the United States. He's former Speaker of the House from Texas, and he was not a New Dealer, really. He fell out with FDR after the 1936 election, and then especially over the third term. And he ended up running against FDR just out of spite, just to protest the third term, and even before FDR had decided to run for a third term. The other one was Jim Farley, who is the chairman of the Democratic Party and the Postmaster General. So he was serving Roosevelt in two roles. But he didn't realize that there was a certain incompatibility in those roles and being loyal to the president. As the story unfolds, I can speak more about them, but they both announced their candidacy. They both ran in the convention in which FDR was ultimately nominated. But they're both kind of sad stories because neither one of them was really equipped to be president. Either one of them would have been a disaster as president.
Right.
I don't think either one could have gotten elected, to tell you the truth, against Wendell Willkie. But in any case, they're the two principal candidates. One of the interesting things about 1940 was why there wasn't a deeper Democratic bench, and there really wasn't. Nobody really wanted to stick their heads up because they thought, well, FDR might want to run, and he'll chop that head off, because if FDR wouldn't indicate what he wanted to do. So he became known as the Sphinx. He wouldn't reveal his secrets to the public.
Yeah.
And
well, he always held his cards close to the vest, and in fact,
very much so.
And Morgenthau, yeah, who was if anybody could consider a friend, and I'm not even sure Morgenthau was his friend, he was friends with FDR. I don't know whether FDR was friends with him. He said he keeps one hand above the table and one hand below the table.
And neither hand
knows what the other is doing. And Morgenthau was very frustrated with him. Of course, he did have some semblance and talk about Harry Hopkins. He looked to push. He always was pushing people, even Robert Henry Jackson, talking about.
Right.
There were a lot of individuals that he
tried to persuade both of them to be interested in running, and of course neither one, for different reasons, didn't do it. Cordell Hull was another one, Secretary of State,
right,
who had helped him shape the foreign policy that was leading the United States in the face of hostilities in Europe. But Hull had absolutely no interest in wanted to remain. So there were some people around, but not many.
Right. You know, in the 1932 campaign, FDR stated there is no indispensable man. But
right,
he was called that by millions of his idolaters. Later on, critics accused him of wanting to be a dictator, actually being one, you know, this indispensable man. How did FDR approach that concern, and what was FDR's strategy? Now, how did he take anyone into his confidence on this decision?
There's nothing in the written record that indicates that he talked candidly with anyone about this process and what he was planning to do. some people close to him, like Harry Hopkins, you know, knew enough about his thinking to know what they should do on his behalf. And ultimately, FDR got nominated, but it was in kind of a faux draft sort of thing.
Yeah.
And not many people were fooled by it. But on the other hand, the Democratic leaders were kind of antagonized by it. They felt they were being taken for granted. But he, as I say, he wouldn't make up his mind. He wouldn't say one way or the other, because he thought that if he announced he was not running, then he would be a lame duck and he wouldn't be taken seriously by the Congress or foreign leaders. And if he announced he was running, then everything would be seen, everything he said or did would be seen through the prism of politics.
Yeah.
And he didn't want that. So he tried to remain above the fray and to keep his options open. And this is the other characteristic of FDR. He never made an important decision until he had to.
Right. And he,
and one of the people that learned that from him was Hubert Humphrey, who taught me that lesson some years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty good lesson in political life, not to make an important decision until you absolutely have to, because that decision can be better informed by additional information and by additional time. Sometimes the issue even goes away, and FDR loved to see big issues go away
like that.
Well, this one didn't go away.
Right. It's sort of like Ted Williams swinging at the last moment in a pitch. The longer you can and get the bat across the plate, the longer you can see where it's actually going. You know, before we got to a break, we got a couple of minutes. Who was on the other side? Who was Wilkie wasn't the first choice of the Republicans.
No, Wilkie came in late. Really, the front runner was really Tom Dewey, who was then a district attorney in New York. He wasn't yet the governor. Very popular, you know, crime buster, very appealing, young. He was still in his late 30s, and very, very popular because he's putting away the bad guys.
Mm.
Then there was Arthur Vandenberg, senator from Michigan, who was the kind of the quintessential old line senator who didn't have much going for him, except that he was well thought of in the Senate. And then there was Robert A. Taft, who is new to the Senate, but who was the son of a president and who really became the chief conservative spokesman in the Senate and in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
All three of these were highly conservative. They were anti-New Deal, and they were isolationists for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And then they finally, as we'll see, got upset by Wendell Wilkie, who is the quintessential dark horse, who came from nowhere to take the convention.
It's sort of like a repetition of today, a very critical election, especially in terms of the Supreme Court. You have Cruz, who is the quintessential Tea Party conservative, who's liked by no one, and Taft doesn't seem that he was liked by anybody. And you have the newcomer who may come out of the convention. Maybe it'll be Ryan. Maybe it'll be someone in Kasich. It's certainly the party is caught between Cruz on one hand and Trump on the other hand, who they don't like and they don't even understand. You know, it's one thing not liking Cruz. It's another thing having the devil you know and the devil you don't know. And it seems they don't want Trump. But
well, that's a good point, Richard. And history does sometimes repeat itself. But one thing you can tell about a deadlock convention is that sometimes it takes a very unpredictable turn.
Right.
And we could very well be in that situation again this year when the Republicans get together. If Trump doesn't have the delegates, depending upon what the convention decides to do about its rules, it could open the field to almost anybody.
Right.
And, Katie barred the door on that.
And Wilkie, just so people know, on the first ballot, Wilkie had one-third of the delegates of Dewey and only one-fifth or one-sixth of the total delegates. And by the sixth ballot, he had a majority. And after the sixth, he wound up having the vast majority of 998 took to win the nomination. We have to, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP. 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, Richard Moe, about FDR's third term, how it came about. We'll have a very short break, and we'll be back with the next segment. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103 FM in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, author and government official, former chief of staff to Vice President Walter Mondale, Richard Moe. We're talking about the critical 1940 election. You know, Richard, the election of 1940 has been thought by most historians as the most critical for America since the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. Richard, why was this election so critical, and what would have been the consequences if FDR had not run or had lost or someone else had lost in his stead?
Well, it really was a critical election, and I think the analogy with 1864 with Lincoln is an apt one, appropriate. First of all, the fact that FDR won this election really put in place a man of extraordinary leadership skills to guide this country through World War II. He took immediate control, command of the alliance after Pearl Harbor, and I don't think anybody else could possibly have done that, because he had proven himself as a leader who could bring this country through a deep crisis, which he had done with the Depression. His election also began the eclipse of isolationism in the United States. And if somebody else had become president, not Wilkie, but somebody else, that would have been much longer in coming. And the FDR's point here was that he needed time to prepare the country for war. He thought the country would inevitably get wrapped up in this war. Yeah. And so he undertook some programs like Lend-Lease and the Destroyers Deal to help Britain. And these really planted the seeds of the national security state that we have today in the United States. And most importantly, by challenging the third-term precedent, he changed the way we think about the presidency. Because the only issue in the election in 1940 was the war, and what role would America play in getting ready for that war and possibly participating in it at some future time. Ever since then, a candidate's ability to deal with foreign policy has been very high on the public agenda, and rightly so. And we see that again today, because we are, like it or not, subject to different forces in the world. And we need somebody who can keep this country safe, which is the highest responsibility of any president. So he made a huge difference, and I don't think looking back on it, I don't think anybody else could have brought the country through that experience in the same way. Mm.
As in 1914, like the late 1930s, neutrality, the faux safety of the two oceans, and the myth the war would never spread to the New World were pervasive in some quarters. The attitude of the isolationists and the American First supporters paralleled the problem FDR faced as a defense-minded Assistant Secretary of the Navy at the outset of World War I. Richard, why were the isolationists so convinced we would not be involved in the war in Europe?
Well, the isolationists, and it's hard to think back on this period, but the country itself was heavily isolationist because there was huge disillusionment after our involvement in the First World War. People thought that we had been lured into a fight that really wasn't ours. It was a European war. We had no business there. Munitions makers and arms dealers and other industrialists had persuaded us to make these loans to Europe, and then we got sucked into it. And we suffered enormous casualties in that war. And people were very disillusioned about it, and they thought this cannot happen again. So they were determined that the United States would remain free of this war in Europe because we would suffer the same consequences.
And also, there has always been a period of anti-British feeling. A lot of people think that the United States and Great Britain have this marvelous relationship of being cousins. In fact, even today, by 1940, the largest minority group blood-wise was German in the United States. It wasn't even British. And the question is, I assume that in the 20s, in the period of revisionism, when the idea of whether Edith Cavell was really a nurse or a spy, or whether the Germans had bayoneted babies, a lot of these revisionists of the 20s were Germanic Americans who are rewriting the history and saying that we had been sucked into this. The Zimmerman note was a fraud, you know, all these things.
Right.
So how is that almost the same dynamic that we have today with this post-Reagan thinking of anti-government that has now been 30 years seeping into the mindset of the people?
Well, I don't know. I hadn't thought about that parallel, Richard, but you might have something there. But at that time, nobody saw that there was any benefit to the United States. I mean, as you pointed out, they thought we were protected by these two oceans, and we didn't. If we didn't pay any attention to it, it would go away, that issue. Well, FDR was convinced that those two oceans were not going to keep harm away from the United States, and we had to prepare for it. So he just took on the hard reality of trying to educate the American people about that without taking the country into that war before it was ready. He thought it was very important, if we were going to get involved in that war, how we did it. We had to be prepared, and we had to be united.
Well, you know, as a person who's been at the literally intimate in the seats of power of government, we're facing sort of almost a similar situation today in the Middle East, where a lot of people are resentful of nation building. They think it's a failure. They think this policy has not succeeded. Plus, we have a active air drone war against ISIS. And on the other hand, there are people who don't want any troops, boots on the ground, and there are people who want boots on the ground. It's an interesting paradox that it's sort of like the containment of the totalitarians in Europe. How do you do that? Do you aid the allies to do it? Or do you say to yourself, they can't do it and it will spread here? Is there sort of a parallel between?
Well, yes, there is. There is something of a parallel there. And I think you put it well. And this is why we pick presidents, because we want somebody with the judgment to understand these issues, to understand the history and the dynamics of what's going on in the Middle East, and to steer a course that is appropriate for us, with doing the least amount of damage to us and the least amount of American casualties, and yet at the same time now leading the Western powers, at least, and hopefully others, towards some kind of unified approach to dealing with these issues. And there's no easy answer to this.
Right.
And we can see how frustrated the American people are about this. And we can see how frustrated presidents are about trying to get this to happen.
And you know, when you send a soldier into battle and he's dead, he's dead.
That's right.
You know, and he's given the ultimate sacrifice.
Presidents are very aware of that. I was with President Carter. Nothing pained him more than losing the lives of American servicemen when they went on the hostage rescue mission after the Iranian
revolution. It's not an easy thing. I know Truman made the statement that when asked about the atomic bomb, he said, can you imagine the mothers, the daughters, the wives, and the children of men who would be lost in an invasion of Japan if they knew I had a weapon to end the war immediately? So he addressed that, as he always did, pretty much up front. You know, aside in the next minute or so before we come to our next break, aside from the gigantic issue of war and peace and the personality of FDR, were there other domestic issues that may have influenced voters in 1940? What were some of those issues? And I assume they, as you mentioned earlier, they sort of paled in comparison to the war and FDR. Were there other domestic issues?
Well, they all paled in comparison, and there really wasn't another significant issue. Wendell Willkie and the Republicans tried to make the third term a big issue, because no president had ever run for a third term.
Right.
And that's an interesting bit of history. Presidents were unlimited. The Constitutional Convention didn't set any limits. And yet no president ever succeeded in running for a third term, although only two had really seriously tried: Ulysses S. Grant and Teddy Roosevelt, and they both failed for different reasons.
Right.
So the American people kind of thought this was almost sacrosanct. You know, this is not in the Constitution, but it might as well be, because they didn't really want presidents to run for a third term. So FDR had to persuade the American people that in the end, he didn't quite say it this way, this is such an extraordinary emergency facing the country from abroad, that they needed somebody who had been tested and who was capable of bringing the country through a major crisis, and which is indeed what he did, and that was the case for him.
Yeah.
But nothing else. There, you know, the New Deal, as I say, had kind of run its course.
Right.
A country was still recovering from the reset, from the depression, but the increased defense spending was helping to bring it back, mm-hmm. and other federal spending was helping to bring it back. But still, there were a lot of people unemployed. Mm-hmm. But still, those issues didn't dominate. Like, it was the war. Everybody agreed it was the war. Who do we want? And the polls showed a lot of people said, "Well, we don't want to change leaders in midstream here."
Right. Don't change horses in midstream, as they say. You know, we're going to go to a word from our sponsors. This is the Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP 103.9 FM Radio, Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest author, Richard Moe, former chief of staff to Vice President Mondale. In the good old days, as I, you know, I worked in that campaign. I'll tell you about it a little later. That's when a lot of states were purple. You know, now they're blue and they're red, and the five states you compete in. You know, I will be back in a second. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter. I've been talking to my guest, Richard Moe. We've been talking about his book, Roosevelt's Second Act, a very interesting story of how he finessed his way back into the nomination and the election, of course, and as they say, the rest is history. You know, again, in the first segments of our broadcast, with our author, Richard Moe, we've been discussing this critical presidential election in 1940 and how now we're going to sort of segue into a little different theme. Maybe it's very reflective of the fact that Roosevelt really didn't care much for his vice presidents, and maybe didn't people either. There's an old story about the man who had two sons. One went to sea and one became vice president, and neither was heard of again. I don't know whether you ever heard that. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Richard Moe is the unique advantage that few Americans have experienced. 32 years after this critical election, actually, you became chief of staff to U.S. Senator Walter Mondale, and 4 years later, when he became vice president, you became his chief of staff. With that in mind, how did the role of vice presidency change since the days of FDR in the 1940s and even earlier or later? How did it change?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, the Constitutional Convention didn't give the vice president any duties except to preside over the Senate, which was really boring and did not interest many of them at all. So the vice presidency really became, as Nelson Rockefeller famously said, standby equipment. You know, they didn't have much to do and just standing by, taking the pulse of the president every morning. But that changed gradually in the Eisenhower years. Eisenhower gave Richard Nixon an airplane and a few things to do, and he made the most of it and parlayed the experience into the presidential nomination in 1960. He lost the election, of course, but the vice presidency became kind of a springboard for the presidential nomination. But the functions of the office didn't really change until Jimmy Carter interviewed Walter Mondale for the Democratic nomination in 1976. And they had both thought already about trying to make the vice president a substantive office, to try to give the vice president something to do. They saw it as a wasted asset, and the vice president, being the only other nationally elected official in the country, could really be of help to the president in a number of ways. And so during their conversations then, and then some of those conversations after the election, and I was privileged to be present for some of them, they decided that the vice president should become an across-the-board advisor to the president on anything the president wanted to hear about. And in order to do that effectively, he had to have access to all the information of the president and to the president himself. These things had never been granted to a vice president before. And President Carter gave him an office in the West Wing and told his staff and his administration to respond to a request from the vice president as if it came from him, President Carter. and he didn't want anybody in the White House or administration undercutting the vice president, or they'd be out of there. And the net total, the sum of all that, was that Walter Mondale redefined the vice presidency in his experience, and it's one of President Carter's great accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And both of them see that as an important part of their legacy. Mm-hmm. And what's really been important about it is that it's become virtually a permanent change in the vice presidency, right, even though there's nothing written in law or in the Constitution about it. Because every president subsequent to President Carter has used that model, the Mondale model, into what we call the modern vice presidency, and with variations, of course, depending upon the experience and interests of future presidents and vice presidents. But that model remains applicable,
right,
and I think it will. It's serving the country and presidents of both parties very, very well.
Now, one could easily say that President Carter was the first Democratic president who had really no connection to FDR and the New Deal. What were some of the issues that the Carter administration took on, that, and what were their results that were important?
Well, President Carter, you know, he's one of the most interesting people that I've ever known, and it was a great privilege to work with him. I just have enormous admiration for him. He's better known these days for his post-presidency than his presidency. But, you know, I think that's a disservice to him, because his presidency, unfortunately, there are now several biographies in the works on him that I think are going to give him his due, was enormously important. He came to office at a difficult time with the economy, basically in the tank, energy in the tank. But he took on the Middle East, as every president has done it, but he was the only president until today yet who achieved a degree of peace, in this case between Israel and Egypt,
right,
that is still in effect.
Correct.
There hasn't been a shot fired between those two countries in 40 years. And he had his famous Camp David summit.
Right.
He took on the Panama Canal. At great political cost to him and to a lot of the senators who supported it. And that has changed the way that we're viewed in Latin America.
Mm.
And the canal is safe. It's better run by the Panamanians than it was by the Americans. It's so successful financially. They're building another adjacent canal to it. And it's done a lot for human rights. Human rights was a huge issue of President Carter. He made sure this country stood for human rights, whether it was apartheid in Africa or dictatorships in South America or Latin America. The United States of America became known as the beacon of human rights around the world.
Mm.
And there are many other things. He started the transition in our energy crisis towards non-renewable fuels.
Yeah, alternate energy.
And getting off of fossil fuels.
Let me ask you a quick question.
That got vitiated by President Reagan.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, he started us down that path. And there are many, many other instances of how he made really consequential decisions.
Yeah,
he was an extraordinary leader in the White House.
Before we go to a break, one last question. And I think it's very interesting. Of course, it's speculative, of course. Do you think Carter's administration was unfairly judged by the Iran hostage crisis? And could he have been more decisive? That's one perspective. And is that the issue that really defeated him? Could he have won without that issue, do you think?
Well, it's a question that will always linger. I think he was decisive. But the American people were very frustrated. You know, mm. Walter Cronkite would cite how many days it had been,
right,
since they were taken hostage, and people were really getting tired of that, and they didn't think that he was providing any decisive leadership. Well, he was.
Mm.
But he was determined not to cost the lives of the hostages. It would have been easy to send an earlier rescue mission over there or to do something dramatic, simply to appease public opinion, but he wasn't going to do that because he was sure it would mean American lives would be lost. And in fact, he handled that until he decided to launch and authorize a rescue mission, which failed not because of him, but because sand got on the motors of the helicopters that were making the rescue once they landed over there. And tragically, several American service people were killed. The only service people that died during the presidency.
Right.
Who knows if it cost him the election? I mean, there were other factors at work. Clearly, that was a factor.
Right. Yeah, he was.
But in fact, I think you have to keep in mind that he did get the hostages out of there.
Yeah.
It was because of his administration's negotiations that they were actually released. They weren't released until President Reagan took office. But nonetheless, President Carter negotiated that release.
Yeah. Well, I always felt as a person very active in politics in those days, and we're going to go to a break in 10 seconds. I always felt that because he only beat Ford by less than 50.1%, it was like 50.08%, I always felt that he was never that popular as a Southerner, as a small state governor, and as a guy with a drawl and a guy who was a bit different. And wherein Ford to me was absolute clown. I don't want to insult the guy, but and especially
right.
after pardon, of course, let's say he had to pardon Nixon, and Nixon, of course, we know what Nixon was about. But the point is this: I always felt that Carter never had that base of love and support from the start. We have to go to a word from our sponsors. This is The Advocates, Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP FM Radio in Jupiter. I've been talking to my guest, author Richard Moe. We've been talking about his work with Vice President Mondale and President Carter. And we'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, author Richard Moe, wrote a fascinating book a few years ago, Roosevelt's Second Act. We've been talking a bit about his work with Vice President Mondale, President Carter, who is part of his senior staff, how the vice presidency changed, has been changing and really changed in its role under Carter. You've had some great success as an author, a historian, a witness to some remarkable happenings as a member of the president's senior staff. What was, with that in mind, what stands out for you as the most profound happening in those number of years?
Well, it was a great, personally, it was a great window into history being made. I mean, just to be a participant in that White House was very, very exciting, and I had only a modest role, but I was especially pleased to see the vice presidency transformed and to be able to play just a small role in that. And that's something that's had a major effect on the country, and not just on the Carter administration.
Right.
And it's become a lasting accomplishment. But there is so much going on all the time. I mean,
right.
just to be in the White House is to be a witness to history almost every day, and to have the experience to interact with the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States. Was an extraordinary experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
That's big time, I have to say. And Walter Mondale, to me, has always been a great guy. I mean, I actually enjoyed listening to Walter Mondale. I liked him. As I liked Humphrey too, of course, and they sort of came
right.
from the same roots. You know, after those heady days in Washington, I mean, it's tough to do much after that. You took on other challenges that have been critical to America with your work with the National Trust for Historical Preservation. Richard, could you tell us how you became associated with this most important institution, and what were some of the issues you dealt with reflective of historical preservation?
Well, I was very, very fortunate to come by this opportunity, and indeed, it came to me just totally unexpectedly because I had written a book about the Civil War, as you mentioned earlier, and in the course of researching that book, I became involved in Civil War battlefield preservation. Well, it was just a short skip and a jump over to the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Mm.
The timing was right, and the more I learned about the organization, the more I was attracted to it. And I was there for 17 and a half years, and it was really, in many ways, the best job I ever had.
Yeah.
I just loved the chance to get to know this country, to be able to work in New Orleans with local preservationists after Hurricane Katrina, to try to save the very rich historic heritage of that city and the Gulf Coast. I had the chance to lead the restoration effort of what's known as President Lincoln's Cottage here in Washington. It was the old soldier's home,
right,
place where Abraham Lincoln spent a quarter of his presidency, where he drafted the Emancipation Proclamation. It's one of the most interesting historic sites in America, and I hope everyone that comes to Washington will take a look at it.
And he got his shot. Didn't he get his hat shot off riding there?
He did. He did. He would commute to the from the soldier's home to the White House every day, and he had his hat shot off one time. Came galloping back to the soldier's home, and they found his hat later with a bullet hole through it. So it was dangerous. This is the middle of the Civil War,
right, well,
and it was dangerous, but a great place.
Yeah. Well, Lincoln was one of our great, great leaders, one of the great leaders in the world. A lot of people believe that Lincoln was one of the greatest writers of the 19th century. Fascinating individual. Both, it seems that, of course, FDR and Lincoln and, of course, Washington are considered the top three presidents of all time. All
right.
Three of them were tempered by war in that sense, you know, and that's one thing Teddy Roosevelt also, as a volunteer in the Spanish-American War, sort of trying to fill the vacuum after his father had bought his way out of the Civil War. He seemed to say
right.
later that if you don't have a war as a president, it, you know, there's not the chance to make the, you know, the great moves. But, you know, you've been an author, a historian, a key member of a president's senior staff. How many people have done that? Not many. And have worked to restore and repair important parts of America's historical legacy. What stands out to you as the most rewarding of these activities? Is there something that makes you smile every time you think about it?
Well, I prized every one of these opportunities. I was, as I said, I was so lucky to have them. And a lot of it was just serendipitous that I happened to be to fall into them at the right time. And not because of anything I've particularly done. But these, and I think the lesson of that is, first of all, I was drawn to public service, and public service can take a lot of different forms. It doesn't have to be in the government.
Mm.
It can be in the classroom. It can be in the nonprofit sector. It can be serving other people in many, many ways. And I just think that those opportunities are open to all of us if we look for them and if we find the right fit. And that's really what I feel best about, is being able to have some of those opportunities and engage with them, and to write. I love writing also, so it all kind of folds together.
Well, it's I've had the pleasure of interviewing many, many authors over the years. Just the other day, I had James Bradley on, who's written The China Mirage and, of course, Flag of Our Fathers. It's always interesting. I think one of the aspects of Franklin Roosevelt, and of course we don't know whether he would have really written his memoirs. You know, he talked about it, but in fact he never kept diaries. He was very secretive. His letters are pretty sanitized, not by others, but he didn't write. I've read most of his letters, and he really didn't. He really kept his cards close to the vest. You know, he said.
Well, he did, Richard. I'm convinced he would have written his memoirs. I mean, he had already asked Harry Hopkins and Sam Rosenman to come to Hyde Park after the 1940 election to help him write his memoirs, and this is when he was first intending to retire.
Yeah.
And but you're right. There was somebody who was really close to him that has only recently come to life. And that is his sixth cousin, Daisy Suckling.
Oh, yeah, I read her book. I read the book about her, yes.
Thanks to Jeffrey Ward, the historian, that we now have the letters and the diaries of Daisy Suckling. And they became very, very close, not in a sexual way, but somebody that FDR could really open up to.
A confessioner. That was his person he could confess to a degree.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And they spent time at Top Cottage. And but that book, it's called Closest Companion.
Right, it's a wonderful book
by Jeffrey, put together by Jeffrey Ward. And it's if you're interested in Franklin D. Roosevelt, that is really, I think, indispensable reading.
Yeah. It's a great book. I've read it. I read it many years ago. I wrote about it. It's a wonderful book. I've been up to her old home, not too far from his. Very interesting story. I know I'll close with one statement FDR made, sort of reflective of him. He said, if you have something important to say, never put it down on paper.
Right. A lot of people have emails.
He seldom did. Right.
Yeah, a lot of people have emails they'll regret. We've come to an end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank Richard Moe for joining me today. Thank you very much. It was wonderful, as usual.
Thank you, Richard. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where my information on all my guests will be posted. Thanks again to Richard Moe for a great hour. Be well. Bye-bye.